Travis Caleb Decker was the sort of father who never missed a school assembly, who stitched merit badges to Girl Scout vests under the glow of a Coleman lantern, who could name every peak in the Cascades without glancing at a map. So when he drove off with his three daughters on May 30th, 2025, no one, not his ex-wife, not the Wenatchee police dispatcher, not the park ranger who later found the empty truck, imagined the horror that would unfold 48 hours later at a silent campground beside the Icicle River. Plastic bags, zip ties, and three small bodies shattered any illusion that love alone safeguards children. 8 weeks have passed, and the biggest manhunt in Washington since the Green River Killer is unraveling in real time, pitting drones, thermal optics, and federal task forces against a single veteran who knows these mountains better than most cartographers. Credible sightings vanish like mist. Dogs lose the scent in Rockfall. Armchair detectives flood forums with theories. Each unanswered question sharpens the public's dread. How does a man the nation now calls America's most wanted father stay one step ahead? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Setup. The first emergency broadcast pierced the Memorial Day weekend calm at 11:07 p.m. on May 30th, 2025. Whitney Decker had waited 6 anxious hours past the agreed-upon handoff time before dialing 911. By then, the sky above Wenatchee, Washington, glowed violet with distant wildfire haze, and the Columbia River carried its usual cargo of late spring flotsam, pine needles, lost bait buckets, the odd beer can bobbing like a silver warning. Dispatch logged the call as custodial interference, standard code for parents who overshoot visitation. No siren screamed down Cherry Street. No amber banners flashed across phone screens. At 11:32 p.m., Officer Miguel Salas knocked on Whitney's door and listened as she recited the facts with a practiced cadence only divorce court veterans acquire. Parenting plan signed November 12th, alternating weekends. Travis permitted unsupervised outings within Chelan County. Return scheduled for 5 p.m. She spoke quickly, fearful that the speed of her delivery might somehow ferry her daughters home faster. Salas asked if she suspected drug use or domestic threats. Check boxes in a digital form. She shook her head. "He's a good dad," she insisted, even as her voice trembled. Salas entered the missing persons template. Three females, Payton 9 years old, hazel eyes, Evelyn 8, strawberry birthmark behind the left ear, Olivia 5, slight stutter on hard consonants. The system generated file numbers 25-1161 through 25-1163. Somewhere in the bureaucratic ether, alerts stacked like invisible dominoes, each awaiting the nudge of imminent danger before toppling into statewide action. But no one pulled that trigger yet. Travis Decker's white 2018 GMC Sierra didn't ping any license plate readers as it left city limits. The most direct path toward Leavenworth wound west on US 2, past orchards heavy with gala apples and cherry trees just setting fruit. Truck stops along the route are lit like mini stadiums, but security cameras catch little more than ghost reflections on glass. Investigators would later freeze frame grainy footage. Two silhouettes inside the cab, one adult, one child. The passenger window rolled halfway down despite the night chill. They argued over whether it was Evelyn or younger Olivia in that seat. Without audio, the clip was a Rorschach blot for detectives. Some saw fear, some saw boredom, some saw nothing at all. By dawn on May 31st, the story had advanced only in microscopic increments. Travis's phone went straight to voicemail. The last cell tower handshake pinged near Tumwater Canyon, a rugged chute where granite cliffs squeeze the Wenatchee River into froth. K-9 units from Chelan County fanned out along trailheads rated easy by all trails, because, they reasoned, three little girls wouldn't trek far on technical terrain. Helicopter rotors chopped dawn air, searching for the white truck's signature heat block, but the forest canopy deflected thermal imaging like a living shield. Meanwhile, a different kind of heat built online. True crime subreddit moderators merged three late-night threads titled Dad Ghosts W Kids in Washington into one megapost that ballooned to 50,000 views before breakfast. Amateur sleuths cross-checked Travis's Instagram, field photos of trout, elk racks, and a solitary bivy under snow-loaded boughs. With Google Earth overlays, someone unearthed Travis's Army Discharge Certificate on Ancestry.com, posting redacted screenshots that confirmed two tours in Afghanistan, honorably separated in 2021. The comment train derailed into armchair diagnoses. Definitely PTSD. Look up post-military psychosis. Bet he's off his meds, bro. What no one could calculate was the radius of a father's final crisis. Detective Susan Kwan, lead on violent crimes, though this had yet to be classified as one, convened a 2 p.m. briefing at the Chelan County Courthouse, inside a windowless conference room that smelled of old coffee grounds. She taped a laminated topographic map onto a corkboard. Red pushpins speckled Rock Island Campground, Icicle Trail number 1551, and every fire road between Kolchuk Lake and Blewett Pass. Kwan kept her tone clipped, borderline academic. Subject is trained infantry, probable survivalist. He can hole up indefinitely, but the kids cannot. She underlined the final clause on the whiteboard. Time is biological. Every search professional understood the grim arithmetic. Dehydration claims small bodies faster than adults. Hypothermia accelerates when metabolic heat drops. Panic in children erodes rational self-rescue behaviors. Saturday evening ended with a prayer vigil at Pioneer Park. Local TV aired candlelit silhouettes as Whitney clutched three stuffed unicorns left on her porch by neighbors. Come home, she begged into the microphone, her voice raw. Just bring my babies home. Under halogen lights, the plush toys looked accusatory, their stitched smiles fixed forever at half-mast. June 1st, Sunday, delivered no miracle. Instead, midday hikers near Rock Island Campground found a deserted fire pit, its ash scattered in an erratic spiral that suggested a gust of wind or frantic hands. Nearby, boot prints, men's size 11, Vibram sole, crosshatched the pine duff. A purple scrunchie lay half-buried near a rotting log. The hikers photographed everything, posted to social, then resumed their trek without cell signal. Those images would circulate widely before law enforcement even reached the site. When deputies finally canvassed the area that night, floodlights bleached the forest into a monochrome nightmare. At 9:46 p.m., Sergeant Harold Bloom radioed the words, "No responder forgets. We have possible bodies. Three juvenile-sized bagging protocol." Static swallowed any echo of disbelief. Crime scene techs erected blue tarps, but camera flashes punctured the darkness like cruel strobe lights at a carnival gone wrong. Each click marked the death of innocence twice, once for the victims, again for the community. Forensic pathologist Dr. Marin Ortiz arrived just before midnight, donning gloves still powdered from another autopsy across the county. She noted petechial hemorrhaging in sclera, linear abrasions on wrists consistent with nylon ties, and a chilling uniformity. Each child lay supine, arms folded as if coached into reverent repose. No visible ligature marks on necks. Suffocation, not strangulation. Plastic bags remained at the scene, inverted like deflated balloons that had released horror instead of helium. Detective Kwan's phone buzzed incessantly. Press, supervisors, a senator's aide requesting updates for the governor. She stared at the small faces now stamped into her retina and felt the investigation tilt from rescue to recovery, from hope to vengeance. Every homicide detective wrestles with professional detachment, but child victims tear down that firewall without mercy. Kwan closed her eyes, inhaled resin-tinged night air, and rehearsed the media statement. We have located the children. They are deceased. We are issuing a warrant for Travis Caleb Decker on three counts of aggravated murder. The words tasted metallic, like biting a foil gum wrapper. 5 miles away, the white GMC Sierra sat abandoned on a game trail turnout rarely used except by mushroom foragers and hunters who prefer secrecy. The key was missing. So was the battery. Whoever stripped it did so methodically, severing negative and positive cables to mute any low-power tracker law enforcement might deploy. In the truck bed, investigators found a tarp folded with military precision, MRE wrappers, beef stew, menu 9, and a single 5-gallon jerry can half full of diesel, useless to the gas-fueled Sierra, but perfect for concealing scent from tracking dogs if poured along an escape route. By dawn on June 2nd, the case had already metastasized into legend. Cable news plastered Travis's photo beside stock images of mountain ridges. Dad turned killer, ticked across lower thirds, the question mark doing little to mask editorial bias. Social comment sections split along predictable fault lines. Mental health failures, family court negligence, veterans exploited and forgotten. In hallway whispers, prosecutors debated whether Washington's death penalty moratorium would hold if public outrage peaked. Inside the incident command trailer parked at the campground, a hastily assembled task force, local, state, federal, mapped concentric search rings measured in 5-mile increments. Analysts applied probability of detection models originally developed for missing submarines. Each red line crossing the map bore silent witness to the terrain's indifference. Granite doesn't care about legislative budgets. Rivers disregard jurisdictional boundaries. The forest, ancient and resolute, offered both sanctuary and coffin to those who entered. At 2:15 p.m., U.S. Marshal Anthony Reyes took the podium for the first joint press conference. His steel-gray hair and Texas drawl lent paternal authority. "We will find Travis Decker," he assured, eyes scanning a phalanx of microphones like artillery barrels. "If he's in these mountains, we'll flush him out. If he's beyond state lines, we'll bring him back. Make no mistake, this nation will not tolerate the murder of children." The statement resonated nationwide, but in the command trailer, Reyes muttered to his deputy, "And God help him if anyone else gets hurt before we do." That night, as deputies taped thermal illuminators to their rifle rails and pilots filed flight plans for dawn sorties, an alpine thunderstorm rolled over the Cascades. Lightning splintered dark clouds, strobing the ridgelines. Rain hammered the canopy, turning forest floors into sponge. Every drop erased boot prints, diluted scent trails, filled shallow depressions where evidence might hide. Somewhere beneath that deluge, an infantry-trained fugitive repositioned, perhaps burrowing under a fallen cedar, perhaps scaling talus toward a snowfield where no bloodhounds could track. For Detective Susan Kwan, the storm was metaphor made manifest. Truth itself was being washed downstream. She returned to her motel room, peeled off waterlogged socks, and stared at the case board taped to a wall above the spare bed. 3 Polaroids of smiling girls fluttered under the AC draft. Kwan pinned them down with her coffee mug, as though anchoring their memories against the gale outside. Above the photos, she scrawled a single word in red ink Sharpie. "Why?" The question loomed unsatisfied as the night stretched toward morning. Somewhere out there, Travis Decker carried the answer like a malignant secret. And the chase, relentless, unforgiving, morally unavoidable, had only just begun. Chapter 2. Foreshadow. Dawn broke in muted grays, the icicle river's current whispering like a warning through fir and larch. Detective Susan Kwan stood the muddy bank where sheriff's deputies had first cordoned off the crime scene, her breath forming pale smoke in the chill air. A new day meant renewed urgency. Weather forecasts predicted clear skies, giving drones their most effective thermal window since the storm. But clear skies also meant the fugitive's heat signature would stand out against the glassy river and sunlit granite. At 5:15 a.m., Kwan convened her strike team beneath the shelter of a maintenance shed at Rock Island Campground. The map, once dotted with red pins, now bore bright yellow searched overlays, indicating areas scoured without result. She placed a fresh orange pin at a narrow tributary 40 yards north, a potential trail Decker might have followed after abandoning the Sierra. "We've got footprint clusters converging here," she said, tapping the map. "If he's moving north, that's our most viable corridor." Lieutenant Marcus Alvarez from U.S. Marshals pointed to a satellite image on his tablet. "Look at this clearing," he said. "You see how the tree line juts east, creating a wind funnel toward the ridge? Any ridgetop bivouac there would blow smoke eastward, visible to our L3 aviators on patrol." He swiped to a thermal overlay. A small square hotspot glowed faintly. Possible campfire remnant from last night. Could be nothing, could be him. K-9 handler Sergeant Elena Park unleashed Raven, her 2-year-old bloodhound, and sent her down the tributary bank. Raven's nose quivered, tail stricked, as she picked up a scent. "Trails are faint, but persistent," Park reported. Raven led them to a cluster of scoured rocks, soil ground away by boot heels, and a single, as-yet-unidentified article. A dog-eared Boy Scout handbook, spine cracked and pages stained with dew. "Look familiar?" Park asked. On the cover, scratched into the leather, were three letters, P-A-I. Whitney Decker's voicemail lit up Kwan's phone at 6:02 a.m. The message crackled with static. "Detective Kwan," Whitney's voice was tight. I found something in their old playroom. Peyton's scout bag. It's open. Some badges gone. Could be nothing, but I thought you should know." Kwan mouthed the word badge and then spoke into the handset. "We'll send a unit to collect it, Mrs. Decker. Thank you." As she hung up, she traced her finger over the map's legend, evidence chain. By mid-morning, a flatbed truck rumbled in, bearing two uniformed evidence technicians. They approached Whitney's Redmond mobile home with measured caution, carrying sterile evidence bins. The playroom was a museum of the girl's childhood, hand-drawn rainbows muffled with pink construction paper, a shelf of half-read Nancy Drew novels, an easel sprayed with lavender finger paint. The scout bag lay slumped in a corner. Technician Carla Nguyen photographed the spread, then gently upended the bag. Inside nestled a single brown sash, Peyton's merit badges still stitched in neat rows, but three badges were conspicuously absent: orienteering, wilderness survival, and first aid. "A tiger's paw," Nguyen murmured. He stripped the badges. Kwan felt something colder than the early summer wind settle in her chest. Those badges weren't mere decorations. They were emblems of competence, earned through sweat and perseverance. And now they were tools in a macabre breadcrumb trail. Back at the command trailer, Alvarez cross-referenced the missing badges with Decker's Army record. Expert infantryman badge. Survival. Combat water survival. "The parallels are too precise," he said. "He's transferring his daughter's training symbols to his own skill set, or vice versa. It's ritualistic." The assembled team exchanged uneasy glances. Rituals implied intent, planning, and perhaps a motive buried deeper than mere flight. At 1:45 p.m., a drone pilot in Okanagan County airspace detected a faint heat signature drifting northeast, just above background, but persistent. As the pilot, Airman First Class Jaden Liu, maneuvered the drone closer, the heat pixel resolved into a human form, sprawled behind a boulder ledge. "Looks like he's resting," Liu whispered into the comms. "No movement for 2 minutes. Two helicopters vectored in. A Marin County Sheriff's Black Hawk retrofitted for thermal outliers, and a WA State Patrol Bell 407 carrying Kwan and Park. They descended in hover, rotor wash stirring needles and dust. Park's Raven barked, but the fugitive, concealed by hood and heavy black poncho, did not flinch. Kwan peered through her binoculars. There he was. Travis Decker, his silhouette hunched, broad shoulders curved over something small and crumpled in his lap. Below, Park disembarked and sprinted toward the ledge, Raven at heel. Kwan radioed orders. "Hold positions, non-lethal only." But as Park climbed, Raven's bay grew urgent. A child, maybe one of the daughters, lay limp in Decker's arms, shrouded in a lifeless cocoon. Park skidded back when Decker raised his rifle. Raven lunged, barking, forcing Decker's arm upward. A single gunshot cracked. Heat flared on the thermal scope. Decker staggered, clutching his side. He released the small shape and collapsed. Ground teams converged. Park cuffed him as Quan ran to the child. Raven sniffed at the bundle. The girl's breathing was slow but steady. It was Evelyn, alive, though semi-conscious, wrapped in weathered blankets. Medics airlifted Evelyn to Sacred Heart Medical Center. Decker, bleeding, was placed under medicated restraint. On the ridge, Quan leaned against the chopper's skid with Raven curled at her feet. The threat had ended, but an echoing question loomed. Why did Decker leave only one child behind? Night fell over the Cascades as search teams pulled back. The manhunt was over, but the investigation had only deepened its shadows. Decker's capture promised answers and new mysteries. Time, Quan realized once more, was biological, and its reckoning had just begun. Dawn's early light crept beneath the fourth drips in room 412 of Sacred Heart Medical Center. Susan Quan hovered at Evelyn Decker's bedside, her gaze flicking between the girl's pale, feverish cheek and the heart monitor's steady beeps. The child's chest rose in shallow, rhythmic breaths, proof that Decker's bullet had missed her spine by millimeters. Outside, the Cascade Peaks shimmered with morning frost. Inside, grief and relief warred in quiet tension.
"Detective," Nurse Paula Brown whispered, sliding a clipboard across the rail. "Vitals are stable, but she's still sedated."
The chart noted minor hypothermia, mild dehydration, and a bruise blossoming on Evelyn's temple. Quan exhaled. One rescued life was a miracle. Two lost were a scar no one could erase. At 8:30 a.m., federal agents escorted a gaunt Travis Caleb Decker into the hospital's secure wing. His face was ashen, eyes hooded by painkillers and defeat. In the corridor, K-9 Sergeant Elena Park knelt beside Raven, whose ears drooped at Decker's passing. The dog stiffened, sheath of protective instincts undimmed. In the conference room above, Lieutenant Marcus Alvarez convened the Joint Task Force via secure video. Hushed voices reported forensic analysis on Decker's poncho, which bore flecks of synthetic insulation and pollen from alpine heather, evidence he'd camped near subalpine meadows. His boots, dusted with silica-rich dust, matched soils from a remote drainage southeast of Kolchak Lake. Pinpointing the campsite informs motive, FBI profiler Dr. Leila Hassan explained. On the shared monitor, a composite skull chart traced Decker's psychological profile: obsessive ritualism, displaced paternal devotion, escalating desperation. He selected that ridge for its seclusion and its symbolism. Before the murders, he and Peyton mapped every contour in that cirque. It was her rite of passage into orienteering. Now it's his tombstone. Quan pressed her palm against the frosted window pane, watching a helicopter lift off for another sweep. "He brought them there," she murmured. "He taught them to navigate these peaks." The irony stung. What Peyton learned in innocence, Decker weaponized in cruelty. By noon, Decker's rights had been read. His voice, when he spoke, was hollow. "I wanted to save them." The words fractured the room. Prosecutor Alicia Montoya leaned back, brow furrowed. "Save them from what?" she asked gently. Decker's answering silence grew louder than his confession could have. Investigators pored over Decker's living quarters, an austere cabin in Wenatchee's outskirts. Inside, shelves held survival manuals annotated in his block print. Water purification, child dosage, cold weather shelter, minimum volume. Hidden beneath floorboards, Peyton's journal, entries describing her father's gentle praise and strict discipline. But the final page was scrawled in trembling ink. "He says now we must be truly self-reliant. He says the world will take us." That evening, Quan traveled to the shack where Decker had reintegrated after Army discharge. The door bore a fresh coat of pine-scented varnish.
Inside, rain-washed prints on the windowsill suggested a younger child's hand. On the table lay a tapestry of newspaper clippings, stories of veteran suicides, Amber Alert tragedies, and wilderness disappearances. Red string connected them, a twisted roadmap of Decker's descent. Under the single bare bulb, Quan spied a photograph pinned to a makeshift corkboard, Decker cradling baby Olivia on a snowbound hike. Both were smiling, snow-powdered Decker's beard like Dutch Masters highlights. Quan touched the glass. "How did it all go so wrong?" she whispered. Back at headquarters, analysis of digital breadcrumbs delivered new leads. At 2:17 p.m. on May 31st, Decker's banking app pinged a transaction at a sporting goods store, purchase of a gas mask filter, two 10-liter water bladders, and freeze-dried rations. Surveillance video showed him alone, the girls nowhere in sight. It was the final proof that, in his fractured mind, the girls were extensions of his survival doctrine. Resources to be rationed, skills to be honed, even if it meant pushing them beyond mortal limits. As Chapter 2 closed, Detective Quan stood again on the bank of the Icicle River, now drained of its early frost. A single yellow badge, Peyton's Wilderness Survival Merit, dangling from her notebook, glinted in the midday sun. It was a promise unfulfilled, a skill corrupted. In the quiet rush of water, Quan thought she heard a child's laughter, bright, untethered, reminding her why she pursued justice, to restore innocence wherever darkness sought to steal it. The search for motive would define the next phase of investigation. But first, Quan knew she had to reckon with shadows deeper than any forest. Chapter 3. Shift. A week had passed since Evelyn's rescue and Travis Decker's capture, yet the forces arrayed against one another now felt like ghosts chasing ghosts. Detective Susan Wan sat before a broad conference table in the Chelan County Sheriff's Office, the afternoon sun streaming through Venetian blinds and carving stripes across the polished surface. Around her, agents from the USMS, FBI, and State Patrol tapped keys, flipped pages, and exchanged clipped updates. The manhunt had shifted into a prosecution, but every departure from the wilderness offered a chance for new revelations and fresh uncertainties. At 1:12 p.m., Special Agent Clara Dufresne of the FBI stood and spoke. "We've reviewed Decker's initial interview, his 'I wanted to save them' statement. Forensics on his cabin showed no signs of a second rifle or large caliber weapon, but we did find a custom-made silencer in his workbench drawer. He never deployed it, but he clearly planned for fatal contingencies." She clicked a remote, and a slide appeared. A blueprint of the suppressed barrel alongside the plastic bags used at the crime scene. "He's meticulous, almost ceremonial. We need to understand that ritual angle." Quan raised a finger. "Ceremony implies meaning. We saw merit badges removed deliberately. Orienteering, survival, first aid. Did we recover his own badges at the cabin?" Lieutenant Alvarez flipped through binder pages. "Only the expert infantryman and parachutist badges remain. Everything else, combat, water survival, cold weather operations, is missing. He may have sold or buried them. We've canvassed local pawn shops. Nothing has surfaced." A beat of silence. Then Quan said, "Let's refocus on Evelyn's debrief. She's just 8, confused, but she remembers the ridge, the cold, her father's voice. Dr. Hassan, what can you tell us?" FBI profiler. Dr. Leila Hassan adjusted her glasses. "Evelyn's recollections are fragmented, common in trauma, but she consistently describes her father reciting a litany at dusk near the fire. Only the prepared survive, only the loyal endure. She said he held her hand, calling her his compass, then moved to Peyton. After that, her memory goes blank until the gunshot." Quan exhaled. "Compass. He saw her as his guide. Then the girls became symbols in a twisted survival odyssey." She tapped a yellow folder. "I want every page of the daughter's scouting records, Whitney's communications with child services, anything documenting Decker's parenting style." As analysts dispersed to gather files, Quan left the room and headed to forensics division. She passed rows of evidence lockers, rifles, clothing, one-of-a-kind survival gear, and found technician Carla Nguyen. Nguyen held a clear plastic bag containing Peyton's missing wilderness survival badge, dusted with pine resin. "Found this buried under moss near the site where we recovered the girls' bodies," Nguyen said, "wrapped in a bandana with the initials TD stitched in red thread." Quan slipped on gloves. "This confirms ritualistic removal. He made this a trophy." She studied the badge's frayed edges. "We need to trace that thread. Is it military issue or civilian sewing floss?" Nguyen nodded. "Testing now. Also dusted for prints and DNA. Nothing conclusive yet." Quan pocketed the badge and moved to the autopsy reports pinned on the wall. The coroner's notes detailed rigor mortis patterns inconsistent with the timeline Travis provided investigators. Peyton and Olivia's bodies had been refrigerated by night frost, Evelyn's less so, explaining her survival. But the pattern suggested the killings occurred well after dark, contradicting Travis's cell phone pings. "He lied about timing," Quan muttered. Back in the command center, she met Whitney Decker in the observation gallery. Whitney's eyes red-rimmed, but steel behind them. "Detective," Whitney said softly, "I want to ask what happened after Evelyn went blank. I need to know." Quan led her to a map board showing Decker's erratic path, from the old logging road to the boulder ledge, then northeast toward Icicle Ridge. "Your daughters were moved 3 times, Quan explained. "He kept them close to base camp until he grew paranoid about dogs and drones, then shifted them deeper into the cirque, toward a wind-sheltered alcove beneath a rock overhang." She pointed to contour lines and small red X's. "That's where Peyton and Olivia were killed." Whitney's breath caught. "Did they suffer?" The question was unanswerable, and Quan held her silence. Whitney stared at the map, tears building. "He had their badges," she said. "My girls earned mastery, and he weaponized it." That evening, Quan returned to her apartment overlooking the Columbia, a river that never stops, always shifting. She cleared her desk and laid out key exhibits. The badges, the girls' scout handbook, Travis's survival manual, and a small photograph of the family on a summer camping trip. She lit a single white candle. Not as ritual, but to focus. She traced the map's lines in her mind. The storm that blew away scent. The frost that refrigerated truth. The dogged pursuit that rescued one daughter. The hunt was over, but the story had shifted into courtroom battles, mental health debates, and the national spotlight. Tomorrow, the team would interview Decker on recorded tape, hoping to unravel motive. But tonight, Quan stared at the flame and wondered, how do you prosecute someone who believed he was saving his children? And who decides which truths deserve justice when survival itself is a lie? Outside, the river surged on, indifferent. Inside, Quan felt that same indifference sharpen her resolve. The case had shifted from tracking a fugitive to confronting a father's darkness. And that shift, she knew, would demand every resource and every ounce of empathy she possessed. Chapter 4. Pressure Point. Detective Susan Quan awoke to the distant rumble of logging trucks carving through dawn fog on Highway 2. The sun hadn't crested Theds yet, but the world was already stirring. She reached for her coffee mug, bitter fuel she no longer tasted, and glanced at her phone. 5:03 a.m. A new file from the Chelan County Coroner's Office blinked in her inbox. Beneath the subject line, deferred toxicology results, her heart skipped. Decker's cabin processing had yielded trace chemicals on the plastic bags, a cocktail of antihistamines, mild sedatives, and an unmarked veterinary anesthetic. By 6 a.m., Quan was on a call with Dr. Marin Ortiz. "He laced their last night's rations," Ortiz explained, voice measured. "It wasn't enough to kill, but to slow their metabolism. Hypothermia sets in faster." Quan absorbed the calculation. Decker had engineered a biological pressure point, using drugs to weaken his daughters against mountain cold. It wasn't a crime of spontaneity. It was chemical warfare against children. Quan packed her notebook and headed to the morgue. White-tiled halls glistened under fluorescent lights. The scent of formaldehyde lurked in corners. Ortiz met her at the entrance, lab coat buttoned, gloves pristine. "I expanded on the preliminary autopsies," Ortiz said, leading Quan toward a refrigerated drawer. She pulled out two small placards, Peyton Michelle Decker and Olivia Ann Decker. Inside the cold chamber, wrapped in white linen, the girls lay side by side. Ortiz pointed to faint lividity patterns on Peyton's lower back. "She died lying prone, not face up," Ortiz said. "He moved her after death, probably to arrange the tableau." A sink stopper of color drained in Quan's chest. "Olivia's case was different. We found a bruise on her rib cage, likely from being carried or strapped." Quan closed her eyes. "He controlled them until their bodies betrayed him." Ortiz nodded. "The sedative traces align with slow-release compounds. He planned the timeline. This wasn't panic. It was cold calculation." Leaving the morgue, Quan felt the weight of the case press upon her like wet wool. She drove through Wenatchee's fruit orchards, blossoms settling on her windshield wipers like pale confessions. Her destination, Decker's ex-wife, Whitney, who had asked for all findings relating to the children's last hours. Quan arrived at Whitney's modest home just after 9 a.m. A cluster of roses, still dewy, circled a small wooden cross planted in the front yard. Whitney opened the door, eyes hollowed by grief. "Detective," she whispered. Quan led her inside. "Marin Ortiz has new findings," she said softly. Whitney nodded, bracing herself on the kitchen table. Quan laid out printed autopsy addenda, diagrams of heart tissue, toxicology charts, notes on body positioning. "He drugged them," Quan said. "It slowed their heart rates, made them lethargic. Then hypothermia and asphyxiation finished the job." Whitney's hand fluttered toward her mouth. "He made them suffer longer." A shudder ran through her. Quan watched the ripple of pain. "Yes," she said. "He targeted their physiology, knew exactly how to exploit their vulnerabilities." In the afternoon, back at headquarters, Quan reviewed Decker's interrogation transcripts. Despite severe injury and sedatives, he had offered fragments. "They were tired, cold. I couldn't let them freeze." He spoke in halting sentences, each phrase his own undoing. She highlighted the words, "couldn't let them freeze," then circled them in red. He viewed himself as protector, even as executioner. That conflation of roles would be critical in court. Lieutenant Marcus Alvarez interrupted her reverie with news. The U.S. Marshals had located Decker's hidden cache beneath a spillway near Tumwater Canyon. A beat-up duffel of survival gear, extra diapers sized for children, and a collection of handwritten journals. They called it his Plan B. Quan skimmed excerpts. Charts of hourly temperature declines at 3,000-foot elevation, entries on child thresholds, and a final note. "Next time I will teach them better." The phrase twisted her stomach. He had already taught his daughters everything he knew. That evening, the prosecution team met in the Chelan County courtroom. Judge Helena Serrano, stern but fair, had granted a sealed hearing on admissibility of evidence. Quan and Ada Alicia Montoya presented the drug toxicology and journal entries. Decker's defense counsel, Robert Millett, objected to the vet anesthetic finding, arguing chain of custody lapses. Millett's voice dribbled with feigned incredulity. "We ask the court to exclude these results unless the state can prove absolute integrity." Judge Serrano leaned forward. "The state must demonstrate preservation of evidence. However, if chain is intact, the content is admissible." She paused, eyes flicking to Quan, then to Montoya. "Court will hear further testimony on the matter tomorrow." The gavel fell. Outside the courtroom, media swarmed. Flashbulbs ignited like flares, Anchors recited the toxicology revelation as though unveiling a blockbuster twist. Quan slipped away, mindful of the cameras. She returned to her truck, turned the engine over, and allowed herself a single exhalation. The case had reached its pressure point. Every ounce of evidence, every emotional blow, would now be tested in cross-examination. Under the rising moon that night, Quan thumbed through Paiton's orienteering badge, encased in evidence foil. She thought of the girl's compass points and trail markers, metaphors now inverted into macabre coordinates. Tomorrow's battle would pivot on proving Decker's methodical cruelty. But tonight, she stood at her own pressure point, determined to bend the scales of justice toward the memory of three daughters who never lost their way, until their father led them astray. Chapter 5. Secret Revealed. Detective Susan Kwan stared at the grainy surveillance still on her laptop, the image frozen at 2:17 p.m. on May. It showed Travis Decker browsing the aisles of Outdoor Outfitters, a gleam in his eye as he examined a compact GPS unit. Two shelves over lay the very merit badges he'd later confiscate from Peyton's sash. Her chest tightened. This footage wasn't just an alibi. It was the prelude to something far darker. Somewhere in that store, Decker had planted the kernel of his plan, one that would crystallize in the cold mountain cirque when daylight faded. Today, she'd discover what he'd been hiding from everyone, most of all, himself. By mid-morning, Quan and FBI profiler Dr. Leila Hassan assembled in a sterile interview room at the federal building, the walls bare except for a single whiteboard. Hassan, her brow furrowed, traced a diagonal line. Purchase of gear, removal of badges, escalation to murder. He didn't just improvise, Hassan said. He followed a script, one he wrote months before. She tapped the board. We need to unearth that script. Their first stop was the files division, where custodians sorted through Decker's digital footprint. Quan watched as technician Carla Nguyen extracted data from Decker's encrypted hard drive. The cursor blinked over dozens of deleted text files, bits of prose, journal entries, a half-drafted letter to My Little Explorers. Nguyen clicked Recover. Lines flickered onto the screen. The first paragraph read, I taught them to be brave, to map the world. But the world is merciless. A parent must be both guardian and martyr. Hassan's lips curled down. He framed this as a sacrifice. Quan scrolled. Further entries detailed Decker's growing conviction that society would destroy his daughters, childhood's faith corrupted by bureaucracy, courts, even the VA. He wrote of an ultimate journey in the mountains, one that required the children to transcend mortal weakness. By the time he typed, Final Ascent at Icicle Ridge, Expedition to Eternity, Quan felt bile rise in her throat. Quan slid back her chair. This is his confession, she said. We need physical evidence to corroborate what he wrote. Outside, June's sun glittered on the Columbia River as Quan drove to Tumwater Canyon Spillway, the site where hidden duffels and dehydrated supplies had been found. She crouched beneath willow branches, examining the ground where Decker's cache lay 3 weeks earlier. Beneath a layer of silt, she discovered a fragment of torn notebook paper wedged in a pocket. It bore shaky block letters. Tomorrow, we reach the summit. She bagged it and called Nguyen. Scan for matching handwriting. Then she climbed the embankment to the spillway's lip and looked downstream. The dashed concrete spillway, slick with algae, had offered Decker a natural cache for gear. Out of sight of hikers, yet near the river that would erase tracks. It was genius in its cruelty. A means to stay supplied while keeping evidence at arm's reach. Back at the lab, handwriting analysis confirmed the fragment matched Decker's recovered journals. The query was simple. What other plans did he stash in those duffels? Quan ordered a detailed inventory. Rations, baby wipes, a blueprint of the campground's bathhouse plumbing. The bathhouse plan seemed innocuous until Nguyen pointed out faint smudges. Notes about freezing pipes to block water flow. essentially sealing off rescue stations at Rock Island. Quan's stomach clenched. He hadn't just plotted murder. He had orchestrated isolation. By eliminating water access at the campground, he ensured no searchers could stake a claim there after dark. When combined with the sedatives and the cold, the plan was a claustrophobic death trap. That afternoon, Quan and Hassan sat across the interrogation table from Travis Decker, whose hospital green jumpsuit looked incongruous next to the stark metal furniture. A bruised bruise snaked down his right temple. His hands trembled in thick cuffs. Hassan opened the recovered journal and slid it across to Decker. "Why expose your plan in writing, Travis?" Hassan asked. "Why draft it, delete it, and then leave it on your cabin desk?" Decker's eyes glazed. "I needed them to understand. They had to know why." His voice cracked. "If I didn't write it down, if I didn't spare them disbelief, they'd never forgive me." He gestured at the journal. "I was saving them from the world. They deserved faith." Quan leaned forward. "Faith is forged in life, not death. Did you think they'd follow you willingly into that final journey?" Decker looked down. "Pating would have," he whispered. "She embraced orienteering. She wanted tests. She deserved this." Silence pressed into the room. Outside, a murmur of reporters drifted past the one-way glass. That evening, Quan assembled the prosecution exhibits. The GPS receipt, the journal fragment, the bathhouse blueprint, and the confessional entries. Prosecutor Alicia Montoya pored over each item, nodding. "This narrative proves motive," she said. "We show the jury he premeditated everything, from purchase to poison to piping the water." The next morning, Quan visited Whitney Decker, who'd requested all surviving daughter's belongings. In the living room, she handed Whitney Payton's watercolor map of the Icicle Trail. Vivid blues for river crossings, greens for forested trails. Whitney's hand shook as she traced Payton's lines. "She drew every fork, every contour," Whitney said, tears brimming. "She trusted these mountains." Quan placed a hand on her shoulder. "He weaponized her trust," she said softly. "But now, her voice will testify." She left the map with Whitney, planning to offer it as evidence of Peyton's devotion to orienteering, a devotion twisted into proof of her father's intent. Back at headquarters, Quan reviewed Decker's psychiatric evaluations. A troubled history emerged: BPD, PTSD, rage episodes documented by therapists. But deeper in the files lay a sealed court order, a mandate for Decker to complete anger management and parenting classes before each visitation. Records showed he never complied. The order never made it into family court enforcement because his ex-wife's attorney never filed for contempt. That bureaucratic misstep had given Decker one more unsupervised weekend, one that cost 3 lives. Quan's jaw clenched. She drafted a memo recommending a review of custody enforcement protocols and submission of those findings to state legislators. If systemic failure contributed to the tragedy, it needed to be exposed. In the evening's hush, Quan returned to her apartment, where a single Polaroid lay on her desk, a school picture day shot of Peyton grinning behind braces. She picked it up. The world had viewed that photo as proof of a happy child. Now it was emblematic of a life cut short by a father's twisted creed. She set the photo beside her laptop and wrote in her case log: "Secret revealed. Calculated orchestration of environment, resources, and trust. Full premeditation with religious zeal." Beneath it, she scribbled one word: "Prosecute." Tomorrow, she would present the evidence in pre-trial hearings, the most damning mosaic of confession, planning, and manipulation ever assembled in Washington State. But tonight, she allowed herself a moment to honor the daughters whose innocence had guided her investigation: Peyton, the cartographer; Evelyn, the survivor; Olivia, the tender heart. In darkness, the Columbia murmured beyond her window, a river indifferent to human schemes, carving its path as Decker had once carved his in the forest. Yet Quan believed in justice, a force as inexorable as water, capable of wearing down even the hardest rock. And in that belief, she found the strength to endure the coming fight. For the girls, for Whitney, and for the truth that would finally see the secret laid bare. Chapter 6. Fallout. A week after the sealed pre-trial hearing, Chelan County buzzed with anticipation. News crews circled the courthouse like scavengers, hungry for each twist the Decker case. Inside, Detective Susan Kwan arrived at dawn, armed with coffee and conviction. Her evidence binders, thick with autopsy reports, survival journals, and blood-spattered clothing, sat stacked beside the prosecution table. Across the aisle, defense counsel Robert Millett shuffled yellow legal pads, eyes flinty behind designer frames. Judge Serrano entered at 8:45 a.m., her robes whispering against the floor. "Court is now in session on State versus Travis Caleb Decker," she announced. The gavel's rap cracked through the hush. Kwan's pulse tightened as Addie Alicia Montoya rose to summarize the state's case in the pre-trial admissibility phase. Toxicology, premeditation journals, and the waterpipe blueprint. Millett objected only to chain of custody on the spilled spillway evidence and the lab's handling of a veterinary sedative, arguing contamination. Serrano overruled him on all but the spillway cache, granting a full evidentiary hearing for that item later in the day. With procedural hurdles cleared, the judge turned to motions. Millett filed a request to sever the counts, arguing that bundling three murders would prejudice the jury. "My client's cognitive impairments," he asserted, "render individual counts necessary for clarity." Montoya countered that the common scheme, ritual removal of badges, location, and method, warranted a single, consolidated trial. Serrano reserved ruling. Outside the courtroom doors, a throng of supporters and protesters held placards, "Justice for the girls" and "Save the veteran." Whitney Decker stood among them, her face a mask of solemn resolve. A reporter asked if she feared a guilty verdict. Whitney's gaze was steady. "I fear nothing more than forgetting their names," she replied. By midday, the spillway cache hearing convened. Forensic supervisor Elena Park testified on evidence preservation, seal integrity, chain log timestamps, refrigerated storage. Under defense cross-examination, she recounted the windy, remote conditions at Tumwater Canyon and admitted a two-hour gap between recovery and lab notification. Millett pounced. "So evidence sat unguarded overnight?" Park admitted only that a ranger had stood watch until Park arrived. Serrano, narrowing her eyes, reminded counsel this wasn't the guilt phase. "The court finds no fatal break in chain. The spillway evidence is admissible." With rulings concluded, the courtroom clerk scheduled jury selection to begin in 3 weeks. The fall session loomed, promising a months-long trial. Kwan packed her folders, shoulders aching as if she'd carried the case in her arms. Outside, the local community reeled. Leavenworth's summer tourism dipped as families hesitated to book cabins near the enchantments. Hikers paused at trailheads, reading updated warnings on bark-splintered kiosks. One mother snapped photos of the Amber Alert posters lining the general store, running her fingers across her daughter's sandy hair. At headquarters, Kwan convened her internal debrief. "We lost momentum after the pre-trial victories," she told the task force. "Media cycles turned to dog show rescues and wildfire threats. We need to keep the story alive, focus on impact, not just evidence." Lieutenant Marcus Alvarez suggested coordinating with child trauma experts to produce op-eds on systemic failures. Kwan nodded. "And we'll arrange interviews with Whitney. Her advocacy is the human face of this tragedy." In the weeks that followed, Kwan guided Whitney through careful media appearances. She coached her on tone, firm, compassionate, focused on policy reform, stronger custody enforcement mechanisms, and veteran mental health protocols. Whitney's eloquence won attention in Olympia. Legislators agreed to hearings on child welfare enforcement that summer. But Kwan's pride was tempered by frustration. In case files, she uncovered that Decker's court-ordered psychological evaluations had been repeatedly delayed, by VA bureaucracy and family court backlog. Each missed appointment was a bruise on the system. She drafted a confidential memo to state authorities outlining those failures, urging expedited processes. Meanwhile, Decker lay in Chehalis State Penitentiary's infirmary wing, recovering from his gunshot wound. His attorney visited, pressing for bail on medical grounds, a gambit to delay trial. Kwan monitored filings. The defense argued Decker's Ehlers-Danlos syndrome risked cardiac complications. The state countered that his own sabotage of the pickup's battery proved flight risk. Judge Serrano denied bail, citing violence risk and community trauma. Summer waned into an unrelenting heat wave. Wildfires flared on the eastern slopes. The manhunt relics, off-road barricades, and last seen signs melted under scorching sun. Kwan, sweat-stained in her uniform shirt, patrolled the forest's edge to inspect abandoned trailheads. She found graffiti near the campground. "He was saving them," scrawled above a crudely etched heart. Expectations of sympathy from fringe conspiracists unsettled her. Back in Wenatchee, Whitney organized a vigil marking the 60-day anniversary. Hundreds gathered in Pioneer Park. Kwan attended in plain clothes, carrying three white roses, one for each daughter. Whitney spoke of hope through action, urging masks be donated to veterans, funds to mental health nonprofits. At the close, they released lanterns, tiny flares drifting into purple dusk. Kwan watched the floating lights, each a vow to see justice done. That evening at her desk, Kwan received a call from Prosecutor Montoya. Crime Lab found latent prints on the bathhouse blueprint, the water pipe notes. They matched Decker's right index. It was the final link in the chain. Blueprint evidence, premeditation journals, toxicology, and prints. "We're ready for opening statements," Montoya said. Kwan allowed herself a long exhale. As Chapter 6's days folded into one another, Kwan felt the first stirrings of hope and dread. The trial would bring every gruesome detail into public view. Whitney's pain would flash across screens. The defense would paint Decker as a tortured veteran, crippled by PTSD. The jury would bear the burden of three verdicts. On the eve of jury selection, Kwan stood at the courthouse steps, dusk painting the facade in orange glow. She fingered the edge of Peyton's watercolor map, now laminated as Exhibit A. Behind her, justice awaited its moment. Ahead, the trial would test everything she'd fought to build, a seamless narrative of crime, motive, and systemic failure. In that shifting light, Kwan whispered to the empty sky, "Let them remember their names." Chapter 7. Retaliation. A sharp September wind rattled the courthouse windows as Travis Decker's trial began. National media had transformed Chelan County's state government center into a frenzy of satellite trucks and stern-faced reporters. Detective Susan Kwan watched it all from a side entrance, her badge tucked beneath a slate-blue blazer. She noted the camera crews swirling around Whitney Decker, microphones lancing forward, voices demanding a soundbite. Already, the narrative was up for grabs. Was this a case of evil or a tale of systemic abandonment? Inside, potential jurors filed past security, glancing at the defendant, pale, hunched, hands trembling above manacled wrists. Decker projected an air of frail resentment, his eyes darting between his legal team and the crowd. Ada Alicia Montoya's pretrial brief had warned, "Expect the defense to argue that a broken system, mental health, custody enforcement, veteran care, was the real murderer here. We must center the facts and the girls' voices at every turn." Whitney took her seat behind the prosecution, a blue ribbon pinned to her lapel. She fixed her attention on the bench, willing herself to become an anchor for her daughter's memory. The room seemed unable to decide if she was a victim, a survivor, or simply a bereft mother watching her world be dissected. The trial heats up. The prosecution opened with a chilling narrative. Three girls, full of courage and hope, were led into the forest by the one man they should have been able to trust beyond all others. This was not a moment of madness. It was a methodical, monstrous plan. Montoya described the forensic sequence. Sedatives, asphyxiation, manipulation of the water pipes, the ritual badge removals. The evidence, printouts of Peyton's journal, the scrawled campsite notes, Decker's journal entries, marshaled the horror with clinical precision. Quan took the stand to recount the timeline. Her carefully measured testimony walked a tightrope between facts and empathy, detailing the recovery of the children and Decker's premeditated actions. When the defense rose, Millett hammered relationships and failures, missed VA appointments, a court system overwhelmed, a broken man left to parent in the ashes. He referenced email exchanges with therapists, Decker's attempts at getting help, blocked by bureaucracy and inaction. The state made him wait, Millett intoned, and in that abyss, his mind fractured, beyond repair, beyond accountability. Montoya crossed her arms. Broken men do not have license to break children, she returned, voice cold as river stone. Travis Decker planned every step. The evidence is overwhelming. The community response. Outside, the tension boiled over. Protesters from veteran support groups clashed with advocacy organizations calling for justice for Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia. Fix the system, don't scapegoat the sick, one sign read, while another retorted, no excuses for monsters. Local radio hosts debated custody reform and mental health investment. National commentators zeroed in on the perfect storm of flaws that had enabled the tragedy. Quan walked home in the evenings, pausing at the display of lanterns and ribbons outside the courthouse. She read each hand-lettered dedication, never forgotten, not your fault, and found both solace and frustration. Reform talk surged, but it felt performative, fleeting as the drone of news helicopters. A turn in testimony. Midway through the trial, a former army buddy of Decker's, Sergeant Ray Toro, was called to the stand by the prosecution. Toro described Decker's transformative spiral post-discharge. The paranoia, the notebooks, the delusions about protecting his girls from a corrupt world. On cross-examination, the defense tried to cast these stories as evidence of institutional failure, but Toro's blunt sorrow cut through. We're all handed nightmares, but only some people shape them into weapons. Later, Quan worked through new evidence for a possible rebuttal. The forensics lab, spurred by her memo, had flagged a previously overlooked USB stick found taped under Decker's truck battery. Files inside detailed not only the family camping rituals, but a distinct pattern. Photos cataloging every badge, each captioned with notes about purity, trust, or reliance. The prosecution drew a direct line in their closing arguments. This was liturgy, not a lapse. He tied ritual to violence, a betrayal in worship's clothing. Rising stakes. As the trial pushed toward its conclusion, Quan and Montoya prepped Whitney for possible cross-examination. She braced herself, voice ragged after hours of testimony and press. Ask me anything, just don't let them forget my girls. In the gallery, Peyton's watercolored map was displayed alongside framed merit badges, a visual testimony to lost futures. Rumors swirled that the defense might call Decker himself to testify. The possibility electrified the courthouse. Would he confess, deflect, try to refocus the entire narrative? Quan felt the pressure mounting. Years of policing had taught her the stakes of public scrutiny, the cost when stories become battlegrounds. On the trial's 12th day, the clerk summoned all parties for a closed-door session. The defense had signaled a new strategy. One last, desperate gambit that threatened to turn the case on its head. As dusk descended, families and reporters crowded outside, breath visible in the cooling air. Quan looked up at the courthouse windows, the yellow squares glowing like watchful eyes. She knew the retaliation, in all its forms, legal, emotional, communal, was only beginning. And as the sealed chambers echoed with lawyers' arguments, She wondered what price would ultimately be paid for so much unthinkable loss. Chapter 8. Alliances. With the trial deep into its second week, the tension throughout Chelan County had grown thicker than the late summer wildfire haze. Inside the courthouse, Detective Susan Kwan worked late, reading witness statements by the light of her desk lamp. Outside, protesters and supporters alike clustered beneath the rotunda, voices echoing along marble walls. Justice for the girls! Don't scapegoat the broken! For Kwan, the case was no longer just about evidence. It had become a crucible where alliances were forged and tested. Between police and prosecutors, victims and the media, activists and lawmakers, and even among those in the gallery living on opposite sides of the emotional line. The Prosecution's Coalition. ADA. Alicia Montoya's team operated like an elite unit. Kwan, forensic supervisor Elena Park, therapist Dr. Leila Hassan, and child protective advocate Rachel Vega formed the prosecution's Core Four. They met each morning in the courthouse kitchen, strategizing over coffee rings and legal pads. Montoya called in trauma experts to prep Whitney Decker for cross-examination, while Vega trained volunteers to support jurors who might struggle with the case's emotional toll. Their focus? Unity in message and purpose, with the children at the narrative center. Behind the scenes, Kwan coordinated with local police chiefs and the FBI's Victim Witness Division. The task was to prevent leaks, clarify misreported facts, and marshal a legion of supporters who would not let public interest wane. Together, they rebuilt a community's faith in the justice process, one briefing at a time. The Defense's Shadow Network. Meanwhile, Defense Counsel Robert Millett quietly stitched his own web of alliances. Mental health advocates, veterans groups, and court-appointed child psychologists were summoned to discuss amicus briefs and possible expert testimony. Millett met late into the night with Dr. Helen Bristow, a psychiatrist specializing in forensic trauma, to build Decker's diminished capacity defense. In legal filings, Millett's team painted Decker as both a product and casualty of systems that failed to support him after service. Whisper networks of advocates lobbied state legislators for increased funding and leniency for troubled veterans, an alliance that threatened to pull the trial's focus from the facts to the broader, messier realities of American public health. Whitney's support system. For Whitney Decker, support came from the most unlikely places. Local pastors, social workers, and fellow parents packed her living room during a weeknight prayer circle. Flowers and anonymous letters arrived in her mailbox. Solidarity from strangers moved by interviews aired on local news. One ally, child welfare expert Danielle Epperson, helped Whitney draft a speech for state capitol hearings. "We cannot allow paperwork to outweigh protection. My daughters needed the law to work as promised, not as hoped." The alliances built in her daughters' names extended far beyond the case, shaping nascent legislative changes and new protocols for family court enforcement. The fragile ties in the jury box. In the courtroom, the 12 jurors, 9 women, 3 men, became an alliance of necessity. The court assigned a social worker to check in daily, and every evening, a therapy dog named Moose waited in the deliberation lounge to comfort them. The prosecution and defense carefully monitored these interactions, knowing how quickly alliances could shift. Media as ally and enemy. On the courthouse steps, the media's allegiance changed hour by hour. Some journalists stuck with the story's hard truths, reporting on the trial's details and the ripples through the judicial system. Others, desperate for clicks, fomented division, pitting veteran trauma against maternal grief. Kwan learned to favor a selective approach. She worked exclusively with 2 trusted reporters for exclusive background, steering the public toward nuanced understanding rather than easy outrage. The night before. That night, after the gallery cleared and the marble floors echoed with her footsteps, Kwan met with Whitney and the prosecutorial Core 4 in a deserted conference room. They gripped paper cups, all nerves and weariness. Montoya reviewed the plan for cross-examination, and Dr. Hassan reminded them, "This trial isn't just about blame. It's about who stands together after the shattering." Whitney squeezed Kwan's hand in silent thanks. As they parted, Kwan stepped into the cool night, clouds scudding across the moon. The alliances built, some brittle, some unbreakable, were the only thing holding this battered community together as the trial pressed on. Tomorrow, a key witness would testify, and the story would twist again. She drew in the cold air and felt the weight of collective hope. In that moment, alliances crystallized into something deeper, a promise to remember, to fight, and, however imperfectly, to heal. Chapter 9. Collapse begins. The third week of trial dawned beneath a sky threatening late-season thunder. A low-pressure front pressed through Chelan County, bringing humidity and a collective sense of unease. Inside the courthouse, even the marble floors seemed heavier, as if the building itself anticipated collapse. Not of bricks, but of resolve. Detective Susan Kwan, lead witness and reluctant anchor, reviewed her notes in the windowless anteroom. On each page, grief accumulated like rainfall, evidence chains, journal excerpts, raw statements from Evelyn, the sole surviving daughter. The jury feels the strain. By now, the jurors' faces told a story of exhaustion. Lunch breaks grew quieter. Moose, the therapy dog, lingered longer by their feet, receiving absent-minded strokes as transcripts played and replayed, the tale growing heavier with each retelling. The forewoman requested an extra visit from the trauma counselor after a particularly graphic day detailing the children's final hours, a sign even routine legalities no longer protected anyone from the emotional weight. A shifting defense. Defense counsel Robert Millett responded by doubling down on diminished capacity. He called Dr. Helen Bristow, the forensic psychiatrist, who described Decker as a man shaped by war and worsened by institutional neglect, incapable of rational choice. She cited borderline personality disorder, PTSD, and a break from consensual reality. Yet on cross-examination, Montoya countered with Decker's meticulous notes, supply itineraries, water sabotage, badge removal, and a USB drive of encrypted practice drills. It was organized, methodical, and planned. Is it possible, Montoya asked, for disorder to excuse design? Bristow hesitated, a bead of sweat tracking her brow. In rare cases, yes, but this level of forethought complicates the question. Kwan observed from the gallery. Even the experts seemed divided, caught between empathy and horror. The prosecution allowed the pause to stretch, imprinting the jury with doubt. Community and media fracture. Outside, alliances began to fray. After a leaked social media video of a juror hugging a prosecution witness, the defense filed a motion for mistrial. Judge Serrano, voice icy, instructed the press to respect boundaries and initiated sequester protocols. The town's conversations grew sharper, polarizing along the lines of blame and forgiveness. Whitney Decker, buffeted by endless commentary, withdrew from public appearances. She spent evenings at her daughter's memory wall, photos, badges, gentle notes from neighbors, allowing tears to come freely for the first time since the trial's start. The local parents' networks organized meal trains, their solidarity one of the case's few comforts. Prosecution's gambit. The survivor testifies. As the trial reached its nadir, the prosecution took a calculated risk, placing Evelyn Decker, now physically recovered but emotionally fragile, on the stand. Her psychologist and legal advocates were present, and Judge Serrano cleared the gallery except for essential personnel. Softly, under direct examination, Evelyn recounted snatches of that weekend. The cold, her father's whispered prayers, Payton's bravery, the moment she saw stars through the tent's tiny flap.
I missed my sisters,
she said, tracing the edge of a tissue. Dad said we were on a journey. I kept thinking we'd go home. Montoya asked if her father ever spoke of not returning. Evelyn paused, then nodded. When it got dark, he cried. He said the world wanted to hurt us, but he wouldn't let it. The room was silent as she finished. Even the defense allowed a respectful interval before proceeding with scarcely a question. Systemic failures and self-doubt. Back in her office, Kwan assessed the wreckage, of family, procedures, and her own certainty. She reviewed the chain of delayed psychological referrals and VA notices. A new pattern emerged. The state had failed to act promptly, but Decker's own choices, enabled by expertise and obsession, had turned vulnerability fatal. A reminder flashed from the prosecutor's inbox. The press wanted closure, but there were still hundreds of pages of material to digest. Lab results, psychiatric evaluations, timelines, and internal memos circulating among policy reformers. Even within law enforcement, debates simmered about the role of custody courts and the limits of accountability for the unwell. The chapter's final blow. Late that Friday night, lightning struck the transformer at the county's edge, plunging the courthouse and half of Wenatchee into darkness. By generator light, Kwan sat with a handful of colleagues in the command trailer, feeling the weight of what had collapsed. Trust, innocence, the thin scaffolding of procedure that should have kept three girls safe. She scrawled a final note in her case log. Collapse is not one moment, but the slow erosion of everything that holds us together. The next week would bring closing arguments and the first glimpse of what remains when the worst has already happened. Chapter 10. Turning Point. The first hard frost of autumn rimed the courthouse lawn with silver, and inside, the closing arguments were finally at hand. For 3 weeks, the prosecution and defense had traded body blows, method against motive, trauma against planning. But now the case's center of gravity shifted. The trial neared its crescendo, not with revelation, but with reckoning. Prosecutor's closing. Ada Alicia Montoya stood before the jury, voice even but steely. Photos projected on the courtroom wall told their own story. Pyden's watercolor maps and merit badges, the blood-stained duffel, the blueprints of the bathhouse. Each artifact had become a silent, irrefutable witness. Travis Decker did not act out of confusion, but calculation, Montoya declared. He gathered his girls, stripped away their symbols of strength, and led them where nobody could intervene. He prearranged sedatives, sabotaged water lines, and chronicled the steps in his own hand. Mental illness does not align calendars, cross off supply lists, or relocate bodies. This was not the tragic byproduct of a broken mind alone, but the lethal convergence of obsession and control. She gestured toward Whitney Decker, who sat with Evelyn in the front row, her face set and pale. This case is not only about what failed these children in institutions, but about personal choice. Travis Decker believed himself their savior, but his actions wrote tragedy instead. The law must speak for those who no longer can. Defense's final plea. Defense counsel Robert Millett rose slowly, a stack of files splayed before him. He painted Decker as a man whose post-war injuries, diagnosed but never properly treated, striped his judgment and left him a ghost parent moving through systems designed to forget him. He recounted every bureaucratic lapse, the delayed VA appointments, the ignored court orders, the growing mountain of psychiatric referrals stamped pending. Yes, he planned, Millett conceded. But the design was born from a mind at war, with itself, with the world, with demons no one else could see. There is tragedy here, but it is not simple evil. You must consider what happens when law, mercy, and reality collide, and judge accordingly. For a moment afterward, the courtroom was utterly silent, as if absorbing the gravity of the decision now entrusted to 12 citizens. Jury deliberations. Jury instructions were painstakingly read by Judge Serrano. Definitions of premeditation, aggravated circumstances, the threshold for diminished capacity. The panel, weary but resolute, filed out, Moose the therapy dog trailing after, his own tail low. As hours dragged into days, Wenatchee held its breath. Schools closed playgrounds for safety. RV campers near the enchantments reported hushed vigils by the riverbank. National reporters took up residence at the courthouse steps, scraping for any sign, a notepad, a gesture, of which way the verdict might lean. Inside the courthouse, Kwan, Montoya, and Whitney sat in the prosecution's war room. Coffee went cold. Papers shifted from neat piles to jagged stacks. Each hour, the clerk's phone rang with jury notes, clarifications, requests for forensic replays, inquiries about psychiatric reports. One request asked for a second viewing of Payton's map, another for the timeline of custody court errors. "Collapse begins at the edges," Kwan remembered writing, "but hope lives in the center." A bolt of unexpected news. The third night of deliberation, a storm battered Wenatchee. Just before midnight, the jury delivered a note at the judge's door. "We have reached a verdict." As the courthouse lights flickered, the building filled with an uneasy murmur, relief, dread, exhaustion. Kwan stepped out into the rain, head tilted upward. Thunder rolled overhead, and somewhere below, she could see Whitney and Evelyn sharing a quiet embrace beneath a borrowed umbrella. Whatever happened next, she thought, would define more than accountability. It would cut a path through a wilderness of pain, offering, if not peace, at least the solid ground of truth. In the gallery, the world waits. Reporters gripped their notepads. Protesters and supporters pressed in against the courthouse doors. For a fleeting minute, everyone, inside and out, waited in the same silence, bound by the gravity of the verdict to come. The turning point, long anticipated and feared, was finally here. The fate of Travis Decker and the story that had convulsed a community now hung on the simple clarity of a jury's word. Chapter 11. Doubt. Rain streaked the broad glass windows of the Chelan County Courthouse, drowning out the muted thrum of last-minute news reporters. Within the jury deliberation chamber, 12 citizens sat ringed around a battered oak table, verdict slips taunting them from the center. Their faces mirrored exhaustion and uncertainty, each one haunted by the details they'd been forced to relive. Outside, anticipation and anxiety pressed against the walls. Families huddled in hospital rooms, protesters clasped trembling candles, and justice felt as fragile as gossamer in a storm. Tension builds. Detective Susan Kwan walked the silent corridor with prosecutor Alicia Montoya. They paused by a vending machine, the clang of coins briefly breaking the anxious hush. "Will the jury see the ritual or just the ruin?" Montoya wondered, sipping stale coffee. Kwan pressed her knuckles into her tired eyes. Someone a monster, someone a martyr. But the girls, what did they want? Just to go home. Down the hall, defense attorney Robert Millett hunched over paperwork, conferring in low tones with Dr. Helen Bristow. The official narrative was crumbling, replaced by gnawing ambiguity. Millett's closing argument still echoed. How does justice look when everyone failed? Institutions, systems, people? In the deliberation room, Juror 12, a retired teacher, reread portions of Payton's journal aloud, voice shaking. "He's a planner, not a madman, or maybe both. If only he'd found help." Juror 6, a nurse, wept behind her palm at the list of sedatives and supply logs. Could anyone who loved his children do this? She wondered. What kind of love destroys? Argument sparked. Were the crimes the result of pathological intention, or the terminal consequence of untreated illness and social neglect? The forewoman steered the focus back to the facts. They'd asked for the judge's clarifications, premeditation, aggravated murder, the technical burden for diminished capacity. Still, no clear consensus emerged. As hours ticked by, fatigue frayed tempers. Juror 2 stormed to the window, staring through rain-streaked glass toward the glowing map of Peyton Decker, posted for all to see in the plaza below. Families in Limbo. Whitney Decker cradled Evelyn in the courthouse's private waiting room, staring at her daughter's nervous hands folded in her lap. For the first time, Evelyn asked, "Will he say sorry, Mom?" Whitney only managed a soft, "Maybe, but we don't need him to." Quan checked on them between phone calls, feeling her own doubt solidify into resolve. Whether the outcome was verdict or mistrial, she would protect Evelyn as fiercely as any advocate. Media and community in standstill. The town braced itself, schools silent, workplaces quiet. Wenatchee's downtown felt deserted. Church bells tolled each passing hour. Online, parents formed digital prayer chains, updating one another on the jury's status. Meanwhile, national commentators debated not just the trial's outcome, but what it said about American brokenness. On courthouse steps, protesters held lanterns and blue ribbons. Some still turned their anger toward perceived institutional betrayals. Others clung to hope. Let them remember the girls. Let justice mean something again. Nightfall and a flicker of hope. As darkness deepened, the jury sent a question. Could they consider evidence of Decker's past trauma only in mitigation, not as full defense? Judge Serrano issued a careful reminder about the scope of law, the boundary between empathy and justice. It was enough to force deliberations back from the edge. After nearly 30 hours, a murmur swept through the corridors. The jury had reached a decision. Quan steadied Montoya with a hand on her shoulder. Whitney drew Evelyn close, bracing for what was to come. As the courthouse bell chimed midnight, Judge Serrano took her seat, robes settling, gavel poised. The waiting, agonizing, relentless, would at last give way to truth, whatever shape it might take. The shadow of doubt remained, but so too did the light of hope. Whatever the verdict, this community, these families, and these investigators understood that even in their doubt, the courage to face the unknowable was its own measure of grace. Chapter 12. Flashback. The courtroom stood frozen as Judge Serrano announced, "The jury will return in 10 minutes. In that hanging space before the verdict, silence rippled through Wenatchee. On courthouse steps, in living rooms awash with late-night TV glow, and in the stunned huddle of prosecutors, defense, and the Decker family. Detective Susan Kwan, heart pounding, stepped into the hallway and found herself pulled backward, memories looping in her mind. The first urgent call, the frantic search, the shattered innocence scattered beneath pine and cold stars. She pressed a hand to the cool tile wall and let herself plunge into recollection. Winter 2017. The early warnings. A different cold winter, before the shadows closed in. Quan, then a new detective, was called to an altercation at a Wenatchee Fiv FW hall. A younger Travis Decker, just returned from Afghanistan, stood outside in the snow, bleeding from a split lip, laughter boiling over into tears. "I'm fine. I was just proving a point," he insisted. The officers knew him, some from nearby towns, others from the close-knit Army Guard units stationed in the valley. Inside, someone had smashed a beer glass. Friends whispered about the dark times that came after deployments. Quan listened, noting the yearning in Travis's voice as he described a need to teach his girls to survive. He spoke of wilderness trips, anxieties about what the world might do to them. She wrote in the thin notebook she'd carried as a rookie, early signs of hypervigilance. Mentions war often, but refuses help. She left the job that night unsettled. The first thread had been laid. Spring 2019, family fractures. The next memory, Travis and Whitney in family court, voices sharp, frustration thickening the stale air. Whitney described mounting worries, Travis's strict routines, his refusal to let the girls socialize, endless lessons in the woods. At the break, Travis caught Quan's eye in the hallway. "I want to keep them strong," he said simply, as if it answered everything. The judge ordered social services to follow up. The resulting report noted discipline, but no evidence of imminent danger. A phrase Quan now found chilling, a licorice dark echo of bureaucratic neglect. Looking back, did we all miss it? She wondered. Summer 2022, The Disconnect. By summer, Travis had begun skipping VA appointments and therapy check-ins. His emails to state case managers grew more erratic. "Nobody's really listening. I'll do it myself." Quan remembered the brief interview with Peyton, who described her father's survival games, how they practiced hiding, how he'd draw maps for her and make her memorize secret trails. The memory panged. Peyton's voice had trembled with both pride and confusion. "He says we have to be ready, even from Mom sometimes." Quan wrote up her findings, flagged the file, and moved to the next case. Winter 2024. Cracks in the ice. Only months before the event, Whitney called police. Travis hadn't returned the girls on time, though he brought them home hours later, pale and apologetic. "We just lost track out on Icicle Ridge," he said. "There were no injuries, no visible evidence. Only the intangible rising of unease, a mother's intuition, a detective's warning left faint in the record. Quan's supervisor had urged caution. We can't intervene until there's a clear line crossed." But the line, in Travis's world, had always been shifting. What was discipline? What was paranoia? What was love sharpened to a point? The day of the disappearances. Memory became sharper, more painful. Quan replayed the tapes. The call from Whitney, the notebook scribbled with three girls missing, the first desperate searches, the drone's infrared sweep over shadowed freeze, the scent dogs baying as thunder rolled through the timber. She recalled her own voice cracking as she briefed the press, the hush that fell when the girls were found, and the small thumbprints left on every object they'd touched. For every clue unearthed, there was a question they'd never answer. Reckoning with the past. Back in the present, Quan blinked tears from her eyes. Every choice, every detail, every meeting, each had built the scaffold that held this tragedy aloft. The trial's verdict would weigh not just on Travis Decker, but upon an entire community's accumulation of warnings, missed chances, and small acts of care or neglect. The bailiff's voice echoed down the marble corridor. "All rise!" Quan straightened her blazer and entered the courtroom, carrying the weight of her memories as both burden and resolve. She thought one final time of Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia, their laughter bouncing down hiking trails, their trust in the adults charged to protect them. The past could not be undone, but perhaps through truth and memory, it could shape something better in the chapters to come. Chapter 13. Spiral. The verdict hung in the air, every heartbeat in the Chelan County Courthouse synchronized to the tension of a single word. Guilty. Judge Serrano's voice was quiet, but unwavering. From the back row, someone exhaled. Relief, dismay, or exhaustion indistinguishable. Outside, the rain continued to fall, blurring the neon blue ribbons affixed to every lamppost. News bulletins erupted across every local station. Inside, the faces of Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia dominated screens. Candlelit vigils blooming across Wenatchee's plazas. The trial's end did not feel like closure, but the beginning of a deeper unraveling for all involved. Aftermath of judgment. Detective Susan Quan moved through the courthouse corridors in a fog. The prosecution huddled around Whitney Decker, whose composure finally broke into silent tears. Evelyn clung to her mother's jacket, face hidden in the folds. The courtroom, emptied of its formalities, held only echoes and the scent of spent candles. Quan retreated to the war room. where case files and notepads spread in chaotic arcs. She sat, hands trembling, replaying the months of investigation. The search grid scrawled across topographic maps, the unspeakable discoveries in the woods, the hollow routines of briefing press and prosecutors. Though the jury's verdict had landed with finality, Kwan felt as if her purpose was draining out with the stormwater trickling down Fifth Street. The defendant's descent. In the adjoining holding cell, Travis Decker's spiral was complete. The news of the conviction registered behind bloodshot eyes as nothing at all. His attorney, Robert Millett, murmured appeals. Sentencing strategy, grounds for mitigation, psychiatric care. Decker barely blinked, staring instead at the graffiti etched into the holding room bench. Initials stacked on initials, years of waiting woven into the metal. A corrections officer memorialized the moment. Some defendants explode, lash out, or plead for forgiveness. He did none of that. It was as if he'd left the world already. Community reverberations. The community's spiral was more public, a collage of grief, debate, and raw remembrance. Churches hosted impromptu services, inviting the town to pray for healing and action. Student counselors circulated through schools, gently answering questions, cautioning teachers to let children grieve in their own ways. On social media, the lines hardened. Advocacy groups called for immediate family court reform, while veteran support organizations decried the verdict as scapegoating, demanding new funding for PTSD interventions. Wenatchee City Council convened an emergency session to discuss the tragedy's systemic roots. Several counselors broke down in open session, admitting their own children played alongside Python and Evelyn years before. The system strains. Kwan and prosecutor Alicia Montoya were summoned to Olympia by the governor's Child Safety Task Force. There, beneath fluorescent lighting and brittle formality, they described the failures, a tapestry of missed warnings, caseload backlogs, lapsed enforcement, and systemic inertia. Each testimony was another turn in the spiral, pulling in policymakers, advocates, bureaucrats. Yet the sense of futility lingered. For every new commission or task force, Kwan felt the truth slipping further away, dissipating, abstracted into statistics and bullet points. Personal reckonings. At home, Whitney struggled to contain her storm. Each room echoed with memories of her daughters, music boxes on a dusty shelf, watercolor trail maps pinned above a small bed, the soft lavender sweater Evelyn refused to wear after the last hike. Each artifact both comforted and wounded. Kwan, too, found herself untethered. She sat long hours at her dining table, badge removed, deliberating whether justice had truly been achieved, or if all they'd managed was a formal ending to an unbearable story. Her phone buzzed with messages of thanks and of blame. "Justice for the girls," one said. "Your system failed him," read another. A community in mourning. Pioneer Park filled again on the Saturday after the verdict. Hundreds gathered for a memorial lantern release, Whitney organizing, Kwan in attendance. This time, the ritual felt less like performance and more like an act of reclamation. The lanterns, tiny flashes of hope, drifted into the cold night air, each rising spiral a silent prayer to forgive, to change, to never forget. Yet beneath it all, the spiral continued, a widening gyre of questions, anger, resolve, and sorrow. Epilogue of the chapter. That night, as Kwan walked through the emptied courthouse parking lot, she looked up at the dark silhouette of Icicle Ridge. Somewhere out there, time and weather were erasing the last traces of what had happened. But for those left behind, the spiral lingered. A wound that would not close, a lesson that refused to offer comfort. In her notebook, Kwan wrote, "Some stories end with answers, some end with new questions, but every true reckoning begins with a spiral." Chapter 14. Exposure. For days after the verdict, the air in Wenatchee remained thick with consequence. News anchors signed off, but the town's wounds ran deeper than any headline could capture. Justice had been pronounced, yet there lingered a sense that what truly needed confronting, root causes, systemic breakdowns, personal hauntings, had only begun to surface. The investigation's opening. Detective Susan Kwan, stripped for now of official duty, was quietly summoned to the state's Office of Family Services. Subpoenas had landed. Oversight hearings began with stiff procedural language. A parade of social workers, VA clinicians, family court staff, and school district psychologists lining up to explain, apologize, or simply recount how Travis Decker fell through so many cracks. The transcripts were damning. Email chains showed urgent referrals delayed by months. Court logs revealed enforcement gaps, hollowed by backlogs and shifting priorities. A stoic school counselor described how Peyton's last drawings, mountain ranges brimming with color, had signaled nothing to teachers except childish exuberance. Nobody, it appeared, had grasped the gravity beneath her optimism. Kwan moved through the halls of Olympia, case files in hand, as lawmakers grilled the agencies that had touched the Deckers' lives. Each session exposed another thread of neglect. "Do you believe, Detective, that these deaths could have been prevented?" one senator demanded. Kwan hesitated, then spoke. The path that led here was not destiny. It was a series of decisions, by individuals and institutions, each one leaving a door open for tragedy to walk through. The public reckoning. Whitney Decker was now a reluctant public figure, testifying with practiced poise. She recounted missed calls, appointments delayed, reports archived. Each story painted a mosaic of vulnerability, one in which her children had become cautionary tales and spurs for change. The legislative committee, rattled by the evidence, drafted bills for faster psychological intervention, mandatory family court reporting, and strengthened custody order enforcement. Activists amplified the hearings online. The local press ran daily features under a banner: System Exposed. Personal Confessions. Kwan, home in her quiet apartment, received messages she never anticipated. Former colleagues admitted relief at the case's end, though they confessed to sleepless nights and second-guessing. A teacher from Peyton's old school emailed, "I should have pushed harder." A VA nurse wrote, "We all felt it coming, but nobody thought it would go this far." Whitney, seeking some closure, opened Peyton's last journal. One entry read, "If I ever get lost, I hope someone remembers to look for me." Whitney's hands trembled as she read, the words illuminating the darkness of what had gone unnoticed. Meanwhile, defense attorney Robert Millett penned an opinion piece for the local paper, acknowledging that he believed in Decker's brokenness but now sees that the system must change for everyone left behind. His confession, frank and unadorned, reminded the community that everyone, even advocates, was forced to confront uncomfortable truths. The National Spotlight. As the story became the focus of a national documentary and investigative podcast, new experts weighed in. Criminologists mapped Decker's progression from troubled veteran to father-turned-fugitive. Child welfare advocates debated how to balance parental rights against red flag warnings. Listeners wrote in from across the country, sharing echoes of their own close calls, systemic failures, and the hard-won lessons that had saved, sometimes failed, their loved ones. The painful specifics of the Decker case catalyzed reform not only in Wenatchee but across the state. Funding for veteran addiction programs expanded. Custody orders now triggered automated alerts for noncompliance. The legal system faced a new expectation that to overlook one warning might mean losing everything. A community changes. In October, as leaves yellowed and the town mourned, Kwan stood at the unveiling of a new memorial garden in Pioneer Park. Three cherry saplings were planted, one each for Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia, under a brass plaque inscribed, "For those lost and for the courage to seek what is hidden." The crowd that gathered was quiet. For the first time since the trial's end, the unity felt genuine, if bittersweet. Dusk settled over the park. Lanterns flickered among roots, promising that memory would not be confined to courtroom files or nightly specials. Looking forward. That night, Kwan returned home, exhausted but hopeful. She thumbed through her old case notebook, this time seeing not just the accumulation of mistakes, but the possibility for redemption. The exposure of hidden failures transforming into a drive for vigilance and reform. There would be scars, she knew, and not every inquiry would answer the questions that haunted the case. But exposure, raw, unsparing, honest, was its own kind of justice. It would perhaps be enough to save another life, to close another open door, before tragedy stepped through again. Chapter 15. Revenge. The autumn air sharpened as Wenatchee adjusted to life after the verdict, but the story's wounds festered beneath the surface. In homes, schools, and courtrooms, anger coiled tight, aimed at failed institutions, at Travis Decker, at the cruel randomness of tragedy. Some sought retribution through policy, others through activism, while a few seethed in private, their grief twisting into something darker. Private vows. Detective Susan Kwan took to her early morning patrols, walking the riverbanks veiled in mist. Her work cell pinged with tips about new custody disputes, desperate parents fearing the next Decker. Each alert was laced with urgency and, increasingly, blame. Why weren't lessons learned sooner? Kwan steeled herself, determined to bend the arc toward prevention, but felt the simmer of resentment as pressure from superiors and the public mounted. Meanwhile, Whitney Decker channeled her pain into advocacy. She wrote op-eds, pushed for stricter laws, and helped draft the Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia Act for automatic review of missed custody exchanges. Yet she could not quell the quiet rage that rose in lonely hours, at judges, at bureaucrats, even sometimes at herself. She fought the urge to let her sorrow dictate her actions, knowing too well how vengeance poisons not just the guilty but all it touches. The defendant's fate. Inside Chehalis State Penitentiary, Travis Decker became a focus of both ire and infamy. Letters poured in, some damning, some disturbingly sympathetic, calling him martyr, villain, or victim of a broken system. Inmates avoided him at first, but soon the news of his crimes made him a target. Food laced with soap, taunts scribbled in toothpaste on his cell walls, threats whispered during recreation. Guards documented several close calls, and rumors swirled about a bounty put up by a group of angered parents. The prison psychologist noted Decker's decline. He refused visits. He turned his meals over, refused medicine, scrawled cryptic notes. One reading, "They don't suffer, they are free." His self-imposed exile marked him as both pariah and warning. Public backlash and institutional response. The fallout turned vengeful in the wider community, too. Online forums dedicated to the victims grew combative, occasionally doxing caseworkers and family court officials. A vandal smeared red paint on the courthouse pillars, never again, forcing authorities to increase patrols. At the state capitol, legislators faced threats from constituents demanding accountability and retribution. Policy reforms were debated not in the measured tones of governance, but with the sharp edge of outrage. Bills were passed rapidly, some so hastily drafted they created new bureaucratic snares, ensnaring innocent parents in a net meant for those like Decker. The limits of justice. Detective Kwan, observing these ripples, pressed for change. In police briefings, in community forums, before the State Judiciary Committee, she spoke candidly. If we use this pain to punish blindly, we risk building higher walls while leaving the doors unguarded. True justice roots out the causes, not just the symptoms. Her words, though published, were often met with anger from those who needed someone, anyone, to blame. Whitney, too, wrestled with this tension. One evening, after a particularly vicious online attack on a former child protective worker, she posted, "We won't heal by seeking revenge. Honor my daughters by saving someone else's." The post was shared, debated, and sometimes derided. But gradually, it shifted the conversation. Reflection and resolve. In quiet moments, Kwan lingered at the new cherry trees blooming in Pioneer Park. She noticed ribbons curled around the youngest sapling, notes from children who had never known the Decker girls but felt the ache of loss just the same. The world, she realized, was full of those seeking revenge for wounds they could neither see nor heal. As storm clouds gathered beyond the Cascades, the true legacy of the Decker case began to reveal itself. A community forced to reckon not just with vengeance, but with the long, messy work of transformation. For Kwan, for Whitney, and for Wenatchee as a whole, the choice remained: to spiral into cycles of revenge, or to labor toward something better, whatever the cost. Chapter 16. The Setup. November found Wenatchee sheathed in frost, the Cascade foothills shrouded with morning vapor. Though weeks had passed since the verdict, routines flickered between numb repetition and an uneasy readiness. An entire town caught between the urge to move forward and the impossibility of truly letting go. Quiet before the next storm. Detective Susan Kwan watched rain slip down her windshield as she parked by the courthouse. Her mind replayed each decision that brought them here. Reforms now churned in Olympia. Every local agency received new protocols, emergency drills, and mandatory custody check audits. Yet, in the undercurrent of change, another kind of preparation was building among exhausted families, anxious officials, and survivors on both sides of the tragedy. For Kwan, her professional world had shifted. She was now a reluctant figurehead for procedural reform, asked to conduct trainings and participate in documentary panels. Yet beneath the public scrutiny, she worked quietly on the setup for a new unit, the Family Crisis Intervention Task Force. Its mandate, catch warning signs before they spiraled into disaster, was almost unbearably personal. Each morning, Kwan joined a new cohort of social workers and trauma counselors. She led them through simulated scenarios: late custody drop-offs, cryptic parent communications, children expressing coded distress. Ripples from the Decker case shaped every policy. "Our job," Kwan instructed, "is to see the setup before the fall." New tensions in the community. Whitney Decker invested her advocacy in prevention. At listening sessions, she cataloged the stories of parents in crisis, children lost in paperwork, veterans isolated by bureaucracy, all seeking someone to notice danger before it struck. The Pating, Evelyn, and Olivia Act had passed, but confusion about its implementation stirred debate. At public forums, Whitney's voice was resolute: "We will not let red flags pile up unseen ever again." Yet anger continued to reverberate. A caseworker doxed online, moved out of state. A judge faced thinly veiled threats from anonymous emails. Schools installed new counselor hotlines, but teachers whispered about witch hunts and the fear of missing one more sign. The community was setting up new defenses, but the strain of vigilance lingered alongside hope. In the shadows. Inside Chehalis State Penitentiary, Travis Decker became oddly aware of the structures growing outside his cell. Rules and oversight created in response to his actions. Guards spoke of increased mental health screening and faster interventions. Decker watched impassively, immersed in journals no one read. His only acknowledgement of the world's adjustment was a journal entry scrawled across prison issue stationery. "They build their walls higher now, but will they truly look inside?" A psychologist noted his shifting routines, an inward focus bordering on detachment. Other inmates left him alone. Even in captivity, Decker's legacy was one of unsettled precaution, an experiment in how a single catastrophic setup rewrote an entire system's future rules. Preparing for what comes next. Kwan's task force readied for their first high-risk case review. In the secure conference room, they mapped out care webs and escalation structures, social services, court liaisons, mental health quick response, and police intervention triangles. No detail was left unexamined. Every oversight from the Decker timeline was dissected and transformed into procedural fail-safes. At the end of the session, Kwan posted a photograph of Pai Teen's watercolor map above the whiteboard. Let this remind us why. The setup's reach. Whitney, after sunset, revisited the memorial garden. She watched parents and children trace the cherry tree shadows, hesitant but hopeful. In a community newsletter, she wrote, "The world teaches us to prepare for loss. Our duty now is to set up a net, not just for our family, but for every silent plea. We honor our children not only by remembering, but by changing what's possible for those yet untouched by tragedy." Closing the chapter. The wind swept over the valley that night, lifting scattered leaves and the first shreds of snow. Wenatchee braced for winter, for whatever might come next, not through fear, but through the quiet, careful laying of foundation stones. The setup was in place, not to erase the past, but to catch the warning signals of futures that might still be saved. Chapter 17. The Betrayal. As winter deepened over Wenatchee, the town's surface appeared tranquil, but fissures ran unseen beneath routines and reforms. For some, these wounds yawned wider when accountability faltered. For others, betrayal became a private reckoning. In community halls and policy meetings, in kitchen corners and the cold corridors of Chehalis State Penitentiary, the echoes of the Decker tragedy cast long, uncertain shadows. Tensions among allies. Detective Susan Kwan shouldered a new mantle as head of the Family Crisis Intervention Task Force. With each case her team reviewed, she glimpsed frustrations simmering in the ranks. Social workers burdened by caseloads, school counselors wary of legal liability, foster parents overwhelmed by mandates that seemed to change with every headline. One crisis meeting erupted when a caseworker, Jessica Lynn, admitted she'd dismissed a non-urgent tip about a child's peculiar winter preparations, bunkers, coded maps, survival games. "I did what the manual required," Jessica insisted, voice tight. "But I didn't want to become the next scapegoat. What good is vigilance if even one mistake destroys you?" Kwan, sensing the fatigue around the table, realized the reforms born from tragedy now verged on stoking fear, turning former collaborators into wary guardians of their own reputations. "We promise to catch the signs," she replied quietly. "But we can't let betrayal of trust of each other become the price of learning." The message was met with silence. The wounds were not so easily soothed. Community divisions. Whitney Decker, once a symbol of resilience, now faced a backlash from parents ensnared in new enforcement snares. Support groups grew divided. Some blamed her advocacy for increased family separations. Others pressed her to demand even stricter laws. Meeting after meeting, she pleaded for balance. "We need prevention, not punishment," but saw her words get twisted in the rumor mill. During a town hall, an angry father confronted her. "Do you know how many families your law has split? All because the state's afraid of missing another Decker." Whitney, shaken but resolute, returned home and penned an open letter. "Betrayal is trusting a promise the system could not keep. Let's not trade one heartbreak for new ones." The letter went viral, but it changed little. The town's grief fed cycles of blame. Incarcerated and isolated. Within prison walls, Travis Decker's world narrowed. The vengeance directed at him intensified. An incident in the mess hall left him with a broken wrist, and the guard's reports noted that protective custody is now required. Yet Decker remained mostly silent, writing long, rambling letters never sent. One entry: "They call me traitor to my country, my family. They say I destroyed everything, but betrayal started long before I acted, by the ones who saw and did nothing." A prison chaplain, perhaps the only visitor who lingered, observed, "What haunts him isn't an act of violence, but every moment someone could have reached him and didn't." Still, none forgave him, and no reconciliation seemed possible. The gulf between Decker and the world was a chasm carved by betrayal, his and everyone's. Systemic repercussions. Policy implementation sputtered as case files multiplied. In legislative chambers, officials bickered over technicalities. Which warning signs justified intervention? How much leeway should professionals have before risking their careers? Each hearing replayed old arguments, and the specter of the Decker case silenced many with the threat, explicit or not, of disgrace for failing to prevent the next crisis. Kwan, exhausted by compromise, pushed for a confidential review board, one focused not on punishment but improvement. The idea met resistance. "No one wants to expose the real betrayals," a senior lawmaker muttered. But slowly, professionals who once hid their fears began to share missteps, not publicly, but within those silent, protected forums. It was a start, and maybe the only progress possible in the shadow of such loss. A family struggle. Whitney, preparing for winter holidays, wrestled with traditions now hollowed by absence. She hung three new lanterns outside the house, each bearing a ribbon for her daughters. Neighbors offered condolences, but the sense of betrayal lingered. By the system, by those who vanished after the TV crews left, by a future forever changed. One night, Whitney sat with Evelyn, coloring maps in the soft glow of the kitchen. "Will it always hurt this much?" Evelyn asked. Whitney hesitated, then answered, "Not always. But it's okay to remember who let you down. That's how we learn what to protect. In the next turn." Closing. As the chapter ended, Wenatchee braced against winter's swells, caught between promises of vigilance and the cold reality of trust broken by both institutions and individuals. Betrayal, it seemed, had become everyone's burden to bear. Chapter 18. The Confrontation. As winter's chill deepened over Wenatchee, the courtroom became a crucible for truth, grief, and unresolved fury. The confrontation between Travis Decker and the weight of justice was now palpable, filling every corner of the packed gallery with an electric tension that transcended legal theater. Detective Susan Kwan, seated near the prosecution bench, braced herself for the pivotal moment that would define not only the trial's outcome, but the legacy of the Decker daughters. The defendant's final stand. Travis Decker took the stand, staring out at an audience wrapped with expectation and dread. His voice, when he finally spoke, was raw and unsteady, peppered with long pauses and flashes of clarity. "I did what I thought was right. They were my compass, my reason. The world outside, it had no mercy. So I had to teach them another way. Survival." He recounted a fractured story, blending memories of wilderness expeditions with haunting admissions. The drugs, the cold nights, the rituals of badge removals. His eyes often flickered toward Whitney Decker, who sat composed but shaken. For a brief moment, the fragile line between family and defendant blurred. Cross-examination barrage. Alicia Montoya's questioning was relentless but calibrated, peeling back Decker's justifications and exposing contradictions. She confronted him with his own journal entries that documented the precise planning of each step, the meticulous calculation of sedative dosages, and the chilling blueprint of isolation. You portrayed this as saving them. Did you think about the pain, the fear, the betrayal in their eyes? Decker's voice broke. I thought I was their protector, even if it meant taking them somewhere beyond. Defense Counsel Robert Millett pivoted deftly, emphasizing Decker's undiagnosed struggles, bureaucratic failures of mental health support, and trauma-induced distortion of reality. Millett asked about Decker's military service, PTSD symptoms, and pleas for help ignored by the VA. How can we blame a man abandoned by the very systems meant to heal him? This exchange polarized the courtroom, crystallizing the trial's central conflict. Accountability versus compassion, justice versus understanding. Witness impact. Whitney's quiet testimony before Decker took the stand had already softened many with her plea for remembrance beyond blame. My girls were more than victims. They were bright lights swallowed too soon. Their story is not just tragedy, but a call to care. Her dignified presence lingered in the minds of jurors as the defendant faltered. Dr. Leila Hassan's forensic insights on trauma and obsessive ritual underscored how Decker's mind became a labyrinth of distorted devotion. Her testimony framed the murders not just as crimes, but tragic byproducts of a mind at war. Aftermath and reflection. After hours, Decker left the stand, escorted by guards, his figure gaunt under the courtroom's harsh lights. Susan Kwan exhaled deeply, knowing this confrontation had laid bare the raw, complicated human story behind the headlines. A shattered father, three lost daughters, and a community still struggling to understand. Outside the courthouse, flashes from cameras punctuated the cold air. Protesters and supporters alike waited, but for Kwan, the confrontation was an intimate reckoning, a painful dialogue between justice's demands and the fractures of humanity that made such cases unbearably complex. Chapter 19. The Collapse. Winter's grip on Wenatchee was unrelenting as the final sentences in the Decker case approached. Snow muffled the streets, making the courthouse appear both bunker and mausoleum, a place both for reckoning and for things lost. Inside, every person, the judge, the attorneys, jurors, families, felt the weight of a story winding toward its inevitable collapse. Sentencing day. Judge Serrano's courtroom was silent except for the soft scrape of boots on tile and the clicks of fountain pens signing last-minute filings. Detectives lined the gallery, families pressed close, and reporters clustered along the marble rail. The mood was restrained. No catharsis, only the brittle hush that follows a long siege. The sentencing phase became a parade of impact statements. Whitney Decker read, her voice steady. I came to ask for justice, not vengeance. My daughters will not return, but the choices made here will echo through every child at risk, every parent searching for help. Others spoke. Teachers, friends, trauma counselors, each painting a collage of lost potential and community wounds that would linger far after the courtroom emptied. The defendant's final moments. Travis Decker, at last permitted to speak, rose in his shackles. Thin and pale, he scanned the room, his gaze settling on Whitney and then briefly on Evelyn. I am sorry for what I became, he said, the words rough and splintered. Sorry for failing those I loved most. The world was too loud inside me, and I wanted to protect them from it. I know now that love twisted by fear is no love at all. He faltered. One of the guards gripped his elbow, steadying him. Judge Serrano thanked him and turned to her written decision. Judge's ruling and systemic repercussions. Serrano's judgment was measured and clear. Life sentences for each count, to run consecutively. No possibility of parole. Yet she also spent time addressing broader failures, noting, for the record, that institutional neglect had played a part. This court recommends immediate review of all custody and mental health proceedings affected by systemic delays highlighted here. Let the law protect, not merely punish. As she finished, the impact was felt not only in the defendant's fate, but in the edicts sent to every agency touched by the Decker tragedy. News of mandatory audits, new emergency protocols, and system overhauls spread. The system itself reshaped by collapse. Collective grief and final farewell. Outside, families and supporters gathered as dusk fell and lanterns were lit along the courthouse steps. Whitney placed three at the top and embraced Evelyn. They stood with others, watching soft lights shimmer against falling snow. It was a farewell. They mourned, but also released. The last grasp of despair that held the town. Detective Susan Kwan watched quietly from beneath the portico. She considered the case files now sealed, the reforms just beginning, and the scars the story would leave behind. She knew full well that true closure was illusion. What remained was resilience reknitted from small acts of courage and care. Closing reflections. As the lanterns drifted into night, Kwan wrote in her final report, "Collapse, when it finally comes, is both an ending and an opening, a letting go of what was, and the hard, necessary reaching toward what might still be saved." In Wenatchee, hearts ached but did not harden. The memory of three bright girls, Peyton, Evelyn, Olivia, became not just a story of what was lost, but of what must never be forgotten. The collapse was total, but so was the determination to rebuild. Chapter 20. Legacy. In the months following the trial's end, Wenatchee emerged slowly from winter's hush, the scars of the Decker tragedy both visible and beneath the surface. Yet, from the ashes of loss grew a commitment to prevention, to remembrance, to building anew on the lessons paid for at such a steep price. A changed community. Spring brought cherry blossoms to Pioneer Park's Memorial Garden. Three young trees stood with curled ribbons, visited daily by parents, classmates, and those moved by the legacy of Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia. At the annual festival, families gathered, laying watercolor maps and scout badges at the roots, each gesture a vow to remember, not just the tragedy, but the spirit and dreams of three girls whose story upended the town. Local counselors facilitated support circles for survivors of trauma, their circles expanding to include children, teachers, veterans, and first responders. The town's schools piloted new programs, counseling hotlines, mindfulness training, suspicion reporting protocols, each measure finely tuned to catch the faintest warning signs. The Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia Act became not just law, but a living pledge spoken at every back-to-school night. "We will see you. We will protect you." Enduring memory. Whitney Decker became an advocate for family safety. She spoke at conferences, collaborated with lawmakers, and published a book intertwining her daughter's stories with practical guides for spotting trouble before it turns tragic. She preserved her girls' belongings, maps, photos, notebooks, not as shrines to loss, but as tools to instruct a new generation of parents and professionals. Evelyn grew into adolescence beneath the protective care of her mother and their quietly vigilant community. With each birthday, she honored her sisters by leading hikes along the Cascades and mapping new trails, her eyes always seeking the light through the trees. Institutional change. Detective Susan Kwan, once defined by the Decker case, now led the Family Crisis Intervention Task Force statewide. Her lectures at police academies and child welfare conferences, rooted in both caution and hope, transformed policy and culture. Agencies accustomed to siloed work began to build real bridges, forming crisis response networks as intricate as any orienteering map. Reforms extended beyond Wenatchee. Across the state and nation, custody laws and veteran mental health protocols were reevaluated. What once seemed like a single tragedy became case study, warning, and foundation for advocacy. New mothers named their children after the girls, some hoping their legacy would be life, not sorrow. The stories ripple. Investigative podcasts and documentaries told the Decker daughters' story far beyond the county line, uniting listeners in outrage, empathy, and a shared desire for vigilance. Books, articles, and courses founded upon the case pointed to one message above all. It is not enough to see a warning sign. We must act on it with courage, compassion, and humility. The memory of failure, missed appointments, unheeded warnings, delayed interventions, became fuel for reform. While some wounds could not heal, the work to prevent new ones gathered momentum each year. Closing reflections. On the first anniversary of the verdict, Wenatchee gathered beneath lanterns and cherry trees, sharing laughter, tears, and stories. Detective Kwan, Whitney, and Evelyn led a silent procession through the city, tracing the route of the last family hike. At sunset, they paused on a small hill. Children scattered wildflower seeds, and scouts read Payton's hiking poems aloud. In her notebook, Kwan captured the legacy's lesson. There is no final closure, only the work of remembering, of changing, of loving, fiercely, despite all risk. The legacy of the Decker daughters is not in what was lost, but what we choose to build. Vigilance, empathy, a community that sees every child. The winds shifted gently through the park, carrying voices and prayers into the future, as Wenatchee, forever marked by tragedy, pressed onward, led by memory, transformed by hope.